In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. And please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. I'm talking today with Mark Dutton, a.k.a. Muddy Stardust, musician, producer, and engineer. He's a close associate of our very own Slim Jim Phantom, and he produced and engineered Slim's latest single for Wicked Cool Records, a cover of the early Rolling Stones song Off the Hook, which is also a recent coolest song in the world. I'll play some of that now, followed by my interview with Muddy on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Here with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and my guest for today's coolest conversations is Mark Dutton, aka Muddy Stardust, musician, producer, and engineer. He worked with Slim Jim Phantom on his latest single, Wicked Cool Records release, Off the Hook. That's also our coolest song of the world this week. The tune, of course, covered the early Rolling Stones song. How are you, Muddy?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, excellent. And so happy to be chatting with you now. I've seen you described as being a close technical associate of our very own Slim Jim Phantom, and Slim in turn told me that you were his engineer and that you play bass. I know that you've worked with him on this latest single, Off the Hook, and I know you've played in bands as varied as like LA Guns to the Brian Jonestown Massacre, but let's find out some more about your history. Where are you from originally?
Well, I'm from Fullerton originally, just south of LA. Little town in Orange County.
And my understanding is that bass is not your first instrument. What did you start on when you were growing up?
Well, when I was a kid, I was, tinkering around on the piano, and then I started playing trumpet because I saw Louis Armstrong, and that kind of inspired me. So I was a band nerd in a junior high. And then I actually walked into my cousin's house one time, and him and a bunch of guys from the neighborhood were playing instruments. And there was a bass sitting in the corner, and nobody, wanted to play it. So I picked it up, and that was it.
And so in your household growing up, did your parents play instruments? Did you have any siblings that did so?
You know, my dad, God bless him, he played instruments from when he was a tiny kid. He grew up with, several brothers and a sister in Scotland, and they needed money, like everybody kind of did back then. And he learned to play the accordion, and he would just go to pubs as a little kid. This accordion was half his body size.
Wow.
And he would play and bring in extra money for the family. And my mom played a little bit of piano, but they always encouraged us, to do that, to pursue art and music.
And how many brothers and sisters do you have then?
I have two sisters. He had seven siblings, all living in a single room in Scotland.
Yeah. So what got the, so your dad, you said, was from Scotland. What about your mom?
She moved to Scotland from Italy when she was very young. And opened a fish and chip shop, like a lot of people did back then.
What got them over here to the U.S.?
Everybody wanted to go to the U.S. You know, that was just most people just couldn't get there. They couldn't make it over. My dad was playing gigs in Ireland back and forth, and he forgot his clarinet one time. So he had to get back on the boat to go get his clarinet. And he met an American tourist named Mrs. Kelly, and they became friends. And he talked about how much he loved America and he wanted to move there. And she said, "I'll sponsor you." And she did. And he moved to Pennsylvania. He started working jobs, getting together, saving money, brought over my mom and her mom. And then they all went to California one day for vacation. And they looked at each other sitting on the beach and said, "This is it. We're moving here." You know, and then they eventually bought a house for $25,000 in Fullerton. And that was the beginning.
So now when you mentioned your dad, when, you know, living in the seven siblings living in the one room and, you know, anything they could do to make extra money. So they're playing instruments. So you were never pushed out onto the corner to go busking or anything yourself?
No, I went willingly.
You went willingly. Right. Yeah. So you kind of a band nerd and you were playing trumpet and then this, you saw the bass, you never looked back. Was that like an epiphany? Was that sort of like, you know, this is what I want to do from now on?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I got deep into music when I was a little kid. You know, I liked all sorts of different things. You know, there's always an ego contingency to this stuff too. You know, when you connect to music, you connect to an instrument, but you also connect to that feeling of you know, connecting to an audience on stage and thinking like, wow, I've got something original here and important and interesting. It never really is half as important or interesting as you think it is, but in the long run, it changes things. You know, I mean, music felt much more important to me back then than it does today. Today, it seems like it's just kind of a background. It's like a soundtrack for whatever you're doing at the time. Didn't used to be like that.
So how did you, you were playing with these guys, and then how old were you at that point when you picked up the bass? Like, was that junior high still or high school?
I was that was probably end of junior high, early, like freshman, maybe junior high, freshman high school.
And so after high school, did you continue on with college or did you start just playing with different groups or what was going on?
I did a lot of, I played with a ton of people and I couldn't get enough. We did the guys that I was playing with, we would play every single day and you'd have to stop us. We'd just play all day. But I did go to college. I was a psych major. Mm-hmm. And I went to UC Irvine for a semester and I went to Cal State Fullerton. And in my junior year, I came home one day. I remember I told my parents, "Listen, I'm dropping out of college and I'm going to be a rock star." And of course, you could hear the sound of my parents' hearts breaking, right? But in my head, you had to be that committed. In my head, I was thinking, I'm not going to have a backup plan. That's not real. That's not true. I got to just focus. And I just got really lucky. About six months after that, I got a record deal. I got a record deal with what was CBS at the time that turned into Sony. And that was it from that point forward. You know, that's what I did.
Well, so tell me about this record deal. I'm not familiar with that. What was the deal? What was the group? Was it you as an artist? What was the deal there?
It was, the band was called Burning Tree and it was me, Mark Ford and Donny Gray. Mark Ford later joined, we toured with the Black Crowes actually. And that's how we all got to know each other. And then once I left Burning Tree, he, became the guitar player for Black Crowes for their second record.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Cause, Slim Jim had mentioned a Black Crowes connection. I wasn't sure what that was.
Well, I played with Chris Robinson too. I played for 5 or 6 years in Chris Robinson Brotherhood.
Oh, I see. You know, actually, so I'm going to digress here real quick. So I have a band called the Woggles, and we originally started in Athens, Georgia, but the guys
that were the guitar players, the rhythm guitar player and the original lead guitar player, both had played with the brothers in Mr. Crow's Garden. And the guy that was our lead guitar player, Jeff Matthews, who had been the bass player there in Mr. Crow's Garden for, you know, he lasted a lot longer than a lot of those early members did, you know, because they had a lot of, they went through a lot of people before they actually became the Black Crows. Anyway, that's how the Black Crows touch all of our lives there. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, they're doing it again.
Yeah, yeah. So what about all this? So how did you, because it seems like you were playing with like, you've played with all these sort of really varied groups and musicians. Is that just sort of, you know, being plugged into the scene and making connections and following up on things? Or how do you go from being L.A. Guns to Brian Jonestown Massacre?
Well, I produced a Brian Jonestown Massacre record. I was never in the band. I met Anton, their brainchild or their mad scientist. I met him when I was an in-house producer at Peer Music, Peer Publishing in LA. And I was just working with a bunch of different people, through them. And they came in like a hurricane, right? And they came into me. They actually came to me because I was the last guy standing. They had gone through so many people, nobody survived. So I was pretty much their last choice. They were about to go on tour. And we made a record called Give It Back. And then Anton and I became friends, and he had me do his second record, you know, which was a real honor for me because, you know, I was still coming up as a producer, and, you know, I thought as everybody does when they're young, they think they know a lot more than they do.
Yeah.
Right. He was everything opposite to me. You know, he was just, you know, put the guitar on, slap a mic in front of the amp, start playing. Right. And I was the opposite. You know, as a producer, I'm trying to, you know, wrangle both sides. I have to keep the technical stuff in line, and I have to allow the creative stuff to flow. Right.
Yeah.
So he insisted that no tuner was present. He did not want a tuner around, you know, and that didn't make any sense to me because everything sounded out of tune. But when you eventually would bring the faders up to the four guitar tracks that are on there, everything sounded great. It sounded amazing. There was this weird tension and this wabi-sabi going on, you know, with it. And it taught me a lot. That record just made me realize, wow, I can't just, you know, this is not math. It's not just mathematics. There's a lot more to making a great song and making a great record than the technical or the creative. It's also just the energy that you bring and recognizing the role that you have and recognizing the role that the band has.
So now that is a great story. And it makes me wonder at what point were you just not only interested in performing as a musician, playing as a musician, but when did you begin to take an interest in sound engineering and producing?
From the very beginning. You know, I was terrible at it at the beginning, you know, but I had a lot of ideas. I'm very strong-willed. I'm sure people who've met me would tell you that. And I just wanted, I've got something in my head that is always pushing me to make something better, make it, you know, just do the maximum that you can do to make something as good as it can be, you know, and I'm very impatient. I constantly was writing. I constantly wanted to play, and I constantly wanted to do gigs, constantly wanted to make recordings. And to do that, you have to keep moving forward. You have to keep your momentum moving forward. And I just couldn't wait around. I couldn't wait around for the engineer. Couldn't wait around for the, you know, the percussion player to come. I couldn't wait around for the guitar player. So I just learned to just kind of fill in all the blanks and keep things moving forward.
And how did you and Slim first find each other?
Well, Slim had a club, the Cat Club on Sunset, that everybody went to. I mean, everybody. It was just, it was one of those tiny little wonky hole in the walls that was just all personality. The band had to squeeze up onto a tiny stage in the corner, but the energy in that room was just incredible. And, you know, that was due to Slim's design.
Yeah.
And just being a great host, you know, he did what he had to do. He'd hop up on stage, play drums when he wanted to or when he had to. And when he wasn't, he'd be talking to people, you know, pouring you a drink or whatever. So we all kind of came up through that club, really. That and the Coconut Teaser were the two most important clubs in my history. You know, we just started playing together on stage. We'd all jump back and forth. Everybody got to play with everybody. It was fantastic.
Well, wait, let me interrupt for a second. Where was this club at?
It was on Sunset Boulevard, called the Cat Club, kind of near the Whiskey. Tiny, tiny little club. And but absolutely magical. It truly was. And packed. Certain nights were just, you couldn't get in. You know, it's just packed with people and jammed together. You're literally singing on stage and there's a person a foot and a half in front of you, you know, slightly looking up at you because the stage is about a foot high. So it was just really incredible. It was very interactive. You know, people would sing along. Everybody would play a bunch of covers. Sometimes you'd play some originals, whatever. But we just started playing. And so I was playing with Gilby Clark also. I played with Gilby after LA Guns for a few years. And he wanted to put a band together. And so that's what he did. So it was me and Taddy Zigzag, Slim and Gilby. And we called it Colonel Parker. And we made a record. You know, we all kind of wrote together and made this old school record. It was like we went back to the kind of influences and music that we really love. And we made a record together and we toured. And, you know, like so many great plans, you know, the universe had a different idea.
So so that's when you make the connection with Slim. When and where did you guys record, like, Off the Hook?
They did a lot of the recording before I got it. I was mostly in that one. I've done a few songs with Slim, so I want to make sure I get it right, because we've done some stuff where I produced his vocal. I played bass, and we did drums at my little studio, Village Green.
And where is your studio in town then, or in the area?
My studio's in Tohunga.
And so I know the Stones original is on the Rolling Stones Now, that 1965 album. Slim give you any insight at any point why he wanted to record Off the Hook?
Slim is just Slim loves music. He's just got a joy about him, you know. He'll talk to you forever. I don't know if you've ever done an interview with Slim, or, you know, he'll just talk to you forever about this stuff. And he connected with the song, and it seemed random to me, you know, when he brought it to me. But after we started doing it, it's just, you know, it's a great song. It really is. And I love the fact that he reaches so far back to do something like that, you know, because there's a real need for that. There's a real need for when music was this expression of what was really going on in society. You know, it was an organic expression. Not now. Not now. We're so bombarded now with all these crazy ideas on the internet. It's so big and so Huxleyan, where there's just so much noise going on that it's hard to connect to anything. You know, I remember when I was a kid, when digital, you know, we had Walkmans. That's how old I am, when we were young, and we put cassettes together, playlists on cassettes, right? And if you were romantically, you know, attracted to a girl, you'd put a bunch of songs on there, you'd go to the beach, and you'd listen to those songs. And that was an accurate representation of who you were as a human being, what you wanted to express to this person as a human being, right? Now, I remember when we first got those digital things, I thought, like, wow, this is great. You know, I can put 500 songs on here. And I immediately was disappointed. Like, I don't want 500 songs. I ended up listening to less music. I couldn't figure out what I wanted to listen to. Back then, you didn't have that. You had lots of people in your life which and the relationships were better connected. They were more they were more significant. And now I feel like our art and our music is losing that. And going, you know, doing an old song like that, the way we did it, live recording, live instruments, you know, people who respect that music, respect that time, you know, it's wonderful.
Well, I know that with the recording, Little Steven, Stevie Van Zandt contributes some organ parts to it. So I'm assuming that that was like an overdub that was done remotely.
Yeah, I think I sent, he was very insistent on a very specific sound that he wanted on an organ. It was fantastic. It really motivated me. Actually, this is a really funny story. He wanted a very specific organ on this thing, to call it Farfisa. He has a very, very distinct sounding organ. And when Tim called me, you know, I put an organ part down there, and Stevie said, yeah, it's a great part, but it's not the right sound. I need this and this and this. So we went back and forth and back and forth trying to figure it out. So I told Slim, listen, I don't know, you know, how, I don't have a Farfisa sample. I don't know anybody with a Farfisa. I'll do my best. So I got off the phone with him thinking, well, we're never going to find a Farfisa. So Stevie will probably just, you know, figure out, say, you know, just allow the organ that was on there to stay on there. So I make a call to the first person I know that might have an answer. My friend, John Bird, right? He's another musician I played with for a long time. I said, listen, you know anybody with a Farfisa that I could borrow? He's like, oh, I was about to throw mine out. Come and pick it up. I say, oh, shit, now I have to actually do this, you know? So I go pick up the Farfisa. I bring it back to my studio. I plug it in, and it's a mess. Half of the keys are broken. It's got buzzing. You got to kick it. You got to knock it. So I forced together a Farfisa part as best as I could.
Yeah.
With keys that were there, you know, which actually kind of made it sound cool. It was weirder that way, right? Now, from that point, I don't know what happened. I don't know if that part made it on the record. And I don't know if maybe Stevie put something on there. I can't remember. You'd have to ask him.
Well, so you guys did Off the Hook. Did you do any other recordings?
Yeah, we did. I think we might have done 4 or 5 songs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. Because Slim and I, you know, we randomly work on different projects. He's brought in other projects, too.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up here in a moment, but a couple of things I still want to ask you about is I saw online this thing called the Rocking Horse Academy, which my understanding is maybe it's not an active thing anymore, but it was like combining sort of like a rock school thing with horseback riding. So can you tell me about what that was and what it's morphed into since?
Yeah, I used to live on a ranch, on a horse ranch in Sun Valley. And, you know, I was riding horses, you know, I had my dogs, I had that life. And then I'd go into the city and do my music life. Right. I liked it. I liked being a little bit away from the city. And, while I wanted to try to encourage younger kids to get into the real music, you know, real organic music played by humans. And I was seeing people moving away from that rapidly. So we wanted to start a little music school type thing where you come, you bring your kids, bring your, maybe your daughter wants to record a song, and maybe your son wants to go ride horses, right? This is a little summer camp that you could come. We could do both because my studio was on the property. The horses were around. You could even watch people riding horses from my control booth, you know, like outside the window. So for various reasons, we didn't get that together. So my partner, Audrey and myself, put together a thing called Mr. Muddy's Music Machine, where we did an after-school music program. I think we were in 6 or 7 schools in LAUSD. And we just did Queen, the Beatles. I would write little plays based around a band. You know, and they would sing Queen songs. And of course the kids, I would give them the music to start learning and studying. And of course they had no idea what these songs were. They sounded weird and alien to them. And it's like, they were very resistant, right? And I got to tell you, by the time we were done and ready to put on that show, parents were coming up to me saying, you know, I love you and I want to curse you. These kids will not stop singing Bohemian Rhapsody, Rolling Stone songs. They will not stop. And I would just, at one point with the little kids, you know, I even told this one little girl, she didn't want to do this, a particular song. And I said, well, this is the new unreleased Katy Perry song. And this will be out next year. You'll be able to see. So she started singing it and would not stop singing this song. She just loved it. And it introduced them all to what I grew up with, what I loved, and what I thought was much more human and much more relevant to society.
Well, I like us to go out with a track featuring yourself. And I found out you did a version of Let It Be Me, the song the Everly Brothers did back in 1960, and Dylan covered on his Self-Portraits album. And your version is on Self-Portraits, a tribute to Bob Dylan's Self-Portrait Sessions. As far as Dylan the album goes, there's mixed feelings about that one. How did that project come together and how did you get involved in it?
A friend of mine called me, Bob Hiron called me, and he's the guy that put the thing together. He called me and said, listen, I know you're busy right now, but I'm putting this thing together and I'd really like you to do a track on here. And I said, of course, you know, so I just found that track that I love that song. And, you know, I just threw it together and sent it to him. And then all of a sudden I got a CD in the mail. here's the record.
And why did you want to cover that tune? Why does that song resonate with you?
Fuck me. I mean, I love Bob Dylan, but there's so much to do. You know, you could have done anything, right? But I wanted to do something that was a little, you know, a little off the beaten path. And I just really connected to that. I was going through songs. You know, I didn't have a lot of time. I think I tracked the whole song in a day.
Yeah.
Because I had to, I didn't have, you know, I was in the middle of some other project. So I just threw a drum track down, threw some bass, some guitar, and put a vocal on there and I think I sent it to my friend to mix it. And then we sent it to Bob.
Oh, cool. Well, Marty, thank you for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we're going to give a listen now to your version of Let It Be Me off Self-Portraits, a tribute to Bob Dylan's Self-Portrait Sessions here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Buddy Stardust here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage with a little bit of his version of Let It Be Me, a hit for the Everly Brothers in 1960, and a song Bob Dylan covered on his Self-Portraits album, and Muddy did it on Self-Portraits, a tribute to Bob Dylan's Self-Portrait Sessions. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Muddy for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast, and Kurt Baker for editing. Longtime Southern California rockers Red Cross have got a new eponymous double album out now, their 8th full length, and joining me to talk about it is their bass player, Stephen McDonald. He and his older brother Jeff formed the band back when Stephen was only 11 years of age. Is Stephen McDonald of Red Cross my guest next time around on your Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Bye. Daddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.